Tales of climate change seem to be around us every day, more and more, in fact, from pole to pole. But what about our particular part of the globe, Wisconsin and the waters in and around it? I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me is Steve Vavras. He's senior scientist at the Nelson Institute and the Center for Climatic Research, and he has been doing and will be doing more study of bodies of water in and around Wisconsin. And we'll start in a moment with Lake Superior. But, okay, first of all, let's assume, Steve, welcome to University of the Air, by the way.
Thank you, Norman. Good to be here.
That let's assume that climate change is a real thing. Okay, that will be our premise, despite the, I think, dwindling number of naysayers out there. Usually it's described as being affected or accelerated, at least, by human activity.
Right.
But how far back can we go with that? I mean, sometimes it's just said, oh, maybe the last 50 years. Sometimes it's at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution 200 years ago. How far back can we trace human influence on climate change?
Well, the traditional view is that we can trace it back at least to the Industrial Revolution. And so the warming trend that we've been seeing over the last century, century and a half, unequivocally from temperature records around the world, it's believed that that was really initiated by the carbon emissions as a byproduct of the industrial era. And the research that I'm doing in collaboration with Bill Ruddeman at the University of Virginia and John Kutzbach and Feng He here at University of Wisconsin is arguing that the origin of human influence on global climate actually began not hundreds of years ago with the Industrial Revolution, but actually thousands of years ago with the advent of agriculture. And that really is an unusual perspective and changes our, if it's correct, it would certainly change our understanding of human influence on climate.
Okay, so two questions come out of that. One is, how can you determine climate change going back to the beginnings of agriculture some thousands of years ago? And then two would be, how can you attribute it specifically to agriculture?
Right. So what Bill Ruddeman was actually the person who came up with this idea. And what caught his eye was that when we look at ice core records, we can see the concentration of ancient carbon dioxide and methane levels in the atmosphere. And in past interglacials, like the kind of warm period we're in now, there was a very predictable pattern of these greenhouse gases. And so they would peak early in an interglacial, and then over about 10,000-year lifetime of interglacials, they would decline. And that's exactly what happened during our current interglacial, starting 10,000 or so years ago, the Holocene. And they were declining. And then about 5,000 years ago, there was an about-face, and they started going up instead of down. And that was very puzzling. That hadn't happened before. And Bill tried to surmise what could have caused that. And one very big difference between the Holocene and other interglacials is the existence of agriculture and the carbon emissions that result from that as a function of land clearance, deforestation, and rice cultivation. And so this was the argument put forth, is that probably that humans had an influence through agriculture on promoting higher levels of CO2, methane, and warming climate.
So we've actually been seeing, and in this case we'll call it global warming, for the past 5,000 years, according to this scenario.
According to this scenario, however, there's competing influences. So during these interglacial periods, as they age, so to speak, and get toward the end, there are competing influences that are causing the climate to cool. And so what we think is that there's almost been a trade-off between the two, a tug-of-war. Exactly. And so it's a little difficult to say that there's unequivocally been warming, but we do think that there's been warming relative to the natural cooling that would have taken place in the absence of humans. And we've been testing this in using global climate models. So that's where our involvement at University of Wisconsin has come in, is to use computer climate models with the observed record of methane and carbon dioxide levels going up in the last 5,000 years, and then looking to see what influence that actually has on the climate system.
So is there a kind of an inevitable cycle of glaciation, of cooling, and is that, if so, is that related to the, what is it, the precession of the Earth's axis is through this 26,000-year cycle?
Mm-hmm, exactly. So having to do with changes in the Earth's eccentricity of its orbit around the sun and the wobble of the Earth on its axis as it rotates, and also the timing of when summer occurs. I'll say the strongest solar insolation at different times of the year. So there's three orbital factors that affect the growth of glaciers and then the demise during interglacials. And we understand that pretty well. And that's why it's very unusual that we've had this instance in the last 5,000 years of the carbon dioxide and methane levels going up when the orbital factors should be pulling them down.
So let's say we're 10,000 years into what would be a normal glacial cycle, which means we'd have another, whatever, 12, 15,000 before we'd start icing back over.
Actually, most interglacials have lasted around 10,000 years.
We
go back to the last million. Some are longer, some are shorter. But a typical length is that we'd have about a 10,000-year period of warmth. And that's about the end right now.
We should be there right now.
Exactly.
But instead of getting cooler or downright colder, we're getting warmer.
Right. And so right now, or maybe 2,000 years plus or minus either way, we're at the minimum, the solar minimum in terms of summertime radiation. And so that would favor a cooling and favor potentially the beginnings of new ice sheets. But because of these increases in greenhouse gases, first from agriculture, we believe, but then certainly since from industrialization since then, those two factors have overwhelmed that natural cooling cycle.
If we talk about deforestation as being a factor in global warming, then the premise pretty clearly is that, say, if you have an acre planted with corn, as opposed to an acre of forest, you get much less of a cooling factor from that crop than you do the trees?
Well, it's complicated. So there's a couple of factors at work, at least, and one of which is that as you take, say, a forest and clear it and plant agriculture, you've released all the carbon that was stored in the trees. But then if you replace the a dark forest with something like a not-quite-so-dark crop, then you're changing the reflectivity characteristics of the surface. And so that can also affect the temperature and also the evaporation rate, which also affects the temperature. So we've been including those factors as well in our calculations, but it makes it much more complicated than just a simple case of deforestation leads to carbon emissions.
It sounds, though, as if you would get acceleration on top of acceleration, because if you're decreasing the reflectivity, is it always called albedo?
Albedo, yep.
We usually think of it with snow, but it can, I guess, be with any kind of surface. If you're increasing the reflectivity and at the same time increasing the space that's reflective, it really would compound, wouldn't it?
It depends. To make it more complicated, it depends where on Earth you are. So depending on, like in high latitudes, we think that deforestation, if you take a dark, say, tree surface and replace it with, before cropland, you have snow cover. You're going from a dark surface to a very bright surface. In the tropics, depending on the characteristics of the crop, you can actually have the reverse. And so depending on where you are, these changes in land cover from, say, trees to cropland or bare surface can either be an amplifying effect or a mitigating effect on climate. So this is where you really need to do the modeling, because you can't figure it out from your brain, from first principles.
How does that differ with water, which presumably hasn't changed its reflectivity in the past 5,000 years?
Right. With water, it's a pretty consistent albedo, except if there's ice cover on it. So that's the big difference. If there's ice, it's bright. If there isn't, it's not bright. And we have a good handle on that. So just knowing the solar angle and knowing the presence or absence of ice cover, we know what the albedo of water surfaces is. But the land surface is much more complicated. It depends on the soil moisture, the crop type, and so on.
And I suppose even, of course, the terrain, too.
Right, exactly. Yep, the slope.
Well, so how dire is it then, according to your latest observations?
Well, you know, one of the odd byproducts of this hypothesis that Bill Rudman put forth is that, according to his estimates, that this artificial warming that was initiated from early agriculture was probably enough to stave off the beginnings of the next glacial cycle.
We're going back 3,000, 4,000 years?
Yeah. And so it's not to say that we would be having naturally ice sheets around here, but just the beginnings. It takes a long, long time, many tens of thousands of years, to go from the beginning of a glacial cycle to full-blown ice sheets like we had 20,000 years ago. But Bill is arguing that had it not been for this artificial warming influence from early agriculture, that we would actually be in that early stage of a initial glaciation. And so by that argument, by a fortuitous coincidence, early humans actually benefited or created a climate that was more beneficial for themselves and for their folks who followed, like us. And so this idea of his is controversial on two fronts. One, not everyone believes that early humans could have had that large of a global climate influence. But the other is more of an ethical question, because if you make the argument, if this argument of Ruddiman's is correct, then you could take a simple view and say, oh, so human carbon emissions, that's a good thing because it helped our climate. It kept us out of an ice age. But you wouldn't want to take that attitude and say, well, that means that any amount of carbon emissions like we were doing in the Industrial Revolution is necessarily a good thing.
Well, that does raise an interesting question, though, and that is, let's see, from a human-centric point of view, what is wrong with staving off the next ice age?
Nothing is wrong with it. But if this idea is correct, then it would be sort of a perfect balance between the natural cooling effect being offset just about right by a little bit of warming from early agriculture. But since then, the amount of carbon emitted by the Industrial Revolution has dwarfed what carbon was emitted in the early days from agriculture.
And so what's wrong with that?
Well, a lot's wrong with that, and that's a different topic of research. But the impacts that we're expecting from such a sudden amount of carbon emission compared to the more modest and slower acting carbon release during the last few thousand years is certainly jolting the system in ways that are very difficult to predict.
Well, of course, the difficulty of prediction is one issue. It's a little hard to plan, hard to know where to buy farmland or even beachfront property.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, isn't it making the world more comfortable just by definition?
It would probably – well, it ought to warm the winters, for
right.
example. That
mm-hmm.
might be popular for some people unless you're a winter sports enthusiast. One of the big concerns, though, is the impact that extreme heat has. And many parts of the world, Australia in particular, has suffered tremendously from extreme heat recently. And various lines of research have shown that extremely hot days around the northern hemisphere as a whole, and probably the southern hemisphere too, have been increasing, and increasing at a pretty alarming rate. You know, here in Wisconsin, oddly enough, we've been spared much of that. We've actually had a decrease in extremely hot days over the last few decades. It's not entirely clear why, but that is the exception. If you look at the planet as a whole, the amount of extreme heat has been increasing, and it probably will continue to do so in the future.
So it's not just a matter of more hot days, but days that are record hot.
Yeah, days that are record hot and also high humidity. One of the killers is extreme heat. So days when the air is stagnant, days when it's very humid, days when the nighttime temperature doesn't drop by enough, that's when it's extremely hard on people, particularly older people, people who don't have air conditioning. And it's no surprise that the heat wave deaths go up when you get to those points, when it gets to 100 or so or higher around here.
Now, I've also heard at least a theory that with global warming, there will, of course, be ice melt. And we've seen big chunks of Antarctica, for example. There's one that's like 30 miles long that's mm-hmm. predicted to break off fairly soon. Once you dump all that ice in the relatively warm water of, say, the Atlantic Ocean, is it possible that the actual ocean currents, such as the Gulf Stream, would get shut down? And that, of course, is a moderating influence to keeping things warm.
Right.
Could it backfire?
Exactly. So that was the premise of the Day After Tomorrow, I think, the movie. there is actually some truth to it, not as extreme as in the film, but most climate models, almost all climate models, predict that as we warm the climate, we get some ice melt, we get more fresh water in high latitudes, that actually will reduce the strength of this overturning circulation that draws tropical ocean waters northward toward the pole. And that alone should have a moderating effect on the warming trend. And so by reducing the amount of ocean heat transport coming up from the tropics in the Atlantic in particular, that should have a mitigating effect on the warming in the North Atlantic. And most climate models predict that that will, in fact, happen. However, it's really not an overall cooling compared to present day. It's really a reduction in the rate of warming in the future. So whereas the rest of the region might warm by 3 or 4 degrees Celsius, that region might only warm by 1 degree.
Now, you know, it wasn't until not that many years ago that we even had ever heard of El Nino and La Nina.
Mm-hmm.
I assume those phenomena have been there all along, but just more muted.
They've been around a long time, and people have recorded them for centuries, in fact, and there's historical records we can go back and look at really strong El Nino winters and La Nina winters. So we have a decent handle on how those have varied over time. And it really wasn't until the 1980s, though, where people put it all together about pressure changes in around Australia and anchovy fishermen losing their livelihood because of the warm waters and what was going on in the Central Pacific, and people put it all together, that this is all part of a complex phenomenon that we now call ENSO, El Nino Southern Oscillation. And and now we understand that those changes in the tropics also affect the weather in mid-latitudes where we live.
Well, before we take a closer look at home, I'm wondering, can we project, I use the word guardedly, but can we project winners and losers? In other words, is there going to be prime real estate, prime farmland in Greenland, and a hopeless desert in Oklahoma?
Well, this is a great question, and climate change will affect different regions in different ways, and there certainly will be winners and losers. I mean, to make it sound like everyone's going to be a loser in every possible way is really overblown. But we don't really understand who's going to be a winner, who's going to be a loser, and in what ways. So a very simple way that, that people might be winners around here is that we probably will spend less on winter heating, just as we did this past winter. So that's a good thing, all things being equal. On the other hand, if it leads to more hot summers and we have to use more energy for air conditioning, that could be an immediate offset. So even in that simple example, it's not obvious whether we'll win out economically because of milder winters or hotter summers.
Have we seen changes in precipitation patterns?
We have. And one of the big ones is that we've seen an increase in heavy precipitation. And so one of the very likely impacts of climate change will be an increase in more extreme rainfall. And this is probably going to occur even in regions where there's going to be an overall drying, according to climate models. And the reason for this is that a warmer atmosphere can hold more moisture. And so when the conditions are right for a heavy rainfall, there's more moisture to wring out of that reservoir. And so this is a very simple explanation, but it's a very common occurrence in climate models. And we've actually been seeing increases in extreme rainfall over the past several decades around the United States and much of the world.
Well, even more recently, California would seem to be an example where they were well into a very deep drought and then had a couple of very, very heavy rainfalls, not enough to mitigate the drought apparently, but spectacular rainfalls.
Right. And one of the unfortunate consequences of having a long dry spell followed by heavy rain is that the ground can get so hard and a lot of that heavy rainfall just runs off. And so it doesn't absorb into the soil like you'd like it to. So around here, the best rains are the kind of slow soaking rains that we get often in the springtime. But if we have a very, very dry period for a long time and the surface is just baked, then when we do get a heavy rain, it doesn't benefit as much as you might think.
Well, then we're just about ready to look at some lakes closer to home, bodies of water affected by climate change. And we'll look at Lake Mendota and Lake Superior when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Steve Vavras, and we're looking at the effects of climate change and perhaps some of the prospects, too. We've looked at kind of the global picture insofar as you could summarize that, and now we'll look a little bit closer to home. And not too far from home, and indirectly, of course, affecting home, has been what seems to be more in the last 10 years or so, more really big, violent hurricanes. Is this a pattern that we can determine, or would it just be a more recent impression that we're dealing with there?
Well, we'll need more years of data to know, because these things are sporadic. But climate models do suggest that the strongest hurricanes will probably become even stronger in the future as the ocean water warms. And they differ in whether the frequency will change. So from most of what I hear, it looks like the total number of hurricanes may not change much, or the number of weak ones may decrease, but the strong ones may become even stronger and or more frequent. And so those are the ones, of course, that we care about the most.
And it's kind of a sidebar, I suppose. Sometimes the two are related, but what about tornadoes?
Tornadoes is really an open question. So people have tried to infer how tornadoes may change in the future, but it's a really difficult problem because of the scale. So hurricanes are very large scale. You can track them on satellites, no question, whereas tornadoes are very, very small scale.
And develop very rapidly.
Develop very rapidly, and so they're too small for the climate models to resolve. And so what people have done is try to infer how the conditions, the ingredients that are favorable for creating tornadoes may change in the future. And there's no consensus, because some of the factors favor more and stronger tornadoes and some favor less and weaker tornadoes. So I think the jury's very much still out on that issue.
Well, we promised Lake Superior, and it's kind of a surprise to find that what's the biggest, the deepest of the Great Lakes. And I think it takes, what, something like 220 years or something for Lake Superior, the water in it, to totally turn around. But you're telling me, Steve, that it's actually the most affected of the Great Lakes when it comes to climate change.
Well, we're doing some research that shows that in terms of the summer temperature of the lake surface, that Lake Superior has been responding the most, and it's more so than, say, the smallest lake, Lake Erie. And what we think is causing that is largely has to do with the fact that Lake Superior is very deep. And so what happens with these deep lakes is that they, in the wintertime, they have pretty much a uniform temperature structure to a great depth. And then in the spring and summer, when it starts to warm up, you now have to heat a very deep layer of the lake in order to get a large temperature response at the surface. As the climate warms, that layering becomes more more intense, stratification we call it. And so then in the summertime, you only have to heat the top layer of the lake is very light. And so you only have to heat about, maybe 10 to 30 meters worth to get a large temperature response at the surface instead of 100 meters deep that you would in the winter. And as the climate warms, this stratification effect becomes more common or happens earlier in the year. And so then there's a longer period in the spring and summer when the lake effective lake depth is shallower. And so that sunlight and warm air from the atmosphere can more effectively heat it. And so it's almost like a positive feedback that as you get an initial warming, the lake stratifies earlier. You don't have to heat as deep a lake level to get a warming of the surface.
And how's that actually affecting the lake in terms of, well, let's start with ice cover?
Well, the ice cover has been going down. It fluctuates a lot from year to year on all the Great Lakes, but Superior in particular. And normally, not all of Superior freezes over. In fact, it almost never freezes over completely. The deeper parts stay open, but the shallower areas freeze. And so the warming trend would certainly favor less lake ice. But these effects in terms of the stratification change have big ecological impacts, because that affects the mixing and the nutrient transfer. And so there's lots of ecological ramifications for these climate changes as well, as in addition to lake effect snowfall.
So what are you actually finding?
Well, one of the things that we're finding is that there's this interesting interplay in the future as we try to predict how lake effect snowfall will change. So one of the two factors primarily that affect lake effect snowfall are a warm lake, ice-free lake, ideally, that favors lake effect snow because then you can have this relatively warm, moist surface interacting with the cold overlying atmosphere to create snow. But you also need cold air masses coming down to create the upward motion and the temperature difference between the lake and the air. So in the future, we find that the lake surface should become warmer, and that favors more lake effect snow.
Right.
But on the other hand, if you get fewer of these cold Arctic air masses, which will probably happen as well, then that short circuits the lake effect snow machine. And so we find that there's an interesting interplay for Lake Superior in particular, that it may be that early in the century, maybe by mid-century, that the warming effect of the lake surface will win out and there may be more lake effect snow. But eventually, as we get farther into time and there's fewer of these Arctic air masses coming down, probably less lake effect snow as well.
What would be the effect of less lake effect snow?
Well, it certainly affects the hydrology of that area, and it, in the short term, it causes all sorts of transportation problems, difficulties. It also has a big impact on the soil moisture in those regions and the recharge of the groundwater and discharge into streams and rivers. So it would have a big hydrologic impact. It would certainly have a big economic impact on the snow industry up there in those areas. Lake effect snow has a big is favorable, of course, for the ski tourists. Seasons.
So what about the effects then of this lack of snowfall or lack of precipitation in general in terms of the level of the lake?
Yeah, and that's complicated. The ice cover does have an impact on the evaporation, but it also appears that the evaporation affects whether how much ice cover there is. So this is work that's being done by others more than our group, but it's a very complicated scenario. So there's the lake temperature itself. There's the ice cover as kind of an insulating effect. There's the evaporation during the autumn, which can then set the stage for how much ice you get. So it's a complicated picture, but there are certainly a lot of lake fluctuations, lake level fluctuations over time that have big impacts, not just on the Great Lakes, but also on lakes in Minnesota and Wisconsin as well.
Are we seeing any differences in the Great Lakes in terms of, summertime precipitation?
Sort of downstream effects or... Yeah, our climate model suggests that we'll be seeing changes in those, or in winter, more of the lake effect snow becoming lake effect rain eventually.
Oh, sure.
The summertime patterns, not as clear because there's not as simple a mechanism as there is for lake effect snow.
So what do you actually do up there?
Well, our work is mostly computer modeling, and so we run these regional climate models that are zoomed in on the Great Lakes region. We rely on satellite data. We rely on weather station data to verify these models, but it's not a lot of field work by our group in particular.
But we are seeing more variability even on Lake Superior in terms of climate?
We've certainly been seeing that in the last few years. So we had a very mild winter in 2011 and 2012, not much ice cover. And then we had that severe winter 3 years ago, 2013-14, and there was near or absolute record highs of ice cover on Lake Superior and some of the other Great Lakes. And then this past winter, of course, very mild. And Lake Superior, I don't think the ice cover ever got to be more than about 20%, which is much lower than normal. So we have been seeing a huge amount of variability in the Great Lakes the past few winters.
And you're doing this all just without actually having to go up there?
We can rely on records that are up there. There's every day the ice cover fraction is online, available to anybody. So it takes the fun out of it. You don't get to go
well,
and do field work.
fewer field trips, but if you can get the data through those other means, that sounds like it works very well to show a pattern already.
It's warmer that way.
that too, yeah. So what would you project over the course of the next 10 or 20 years in Lake Superior?
I would say over the next 10 to 20 years, it's going to be largely dictated by just random weather occurrences. There may be sort of an in-between period before the lake warms enough to enhance lake effect snow, and the present time, it may be more of these back-and-forth winters like we've been seeing. There's not a very clear consensus on why we were so cold a couple winters ago. more likely this winter, being mild, was caused by El Nino. But I think that probably these other factors are going to be playing at least as large a role in affecting lake effect snowfall in the near future.
What about the effect of you know, smaller lakes in northern Wisconsin or Minnesota? What are we seeing with those?
Yeah, so those are a little easier because they respond more in more of a one-way manner. So if it's a cold winter, they freeze up, and if it's a warm winter, they don't. We have a great record, a climate record right here in Madison for Lake Mendota. Not only do we have lots of temperature records going back in time, but we have a very continuous record of ice cover starting in 1852. And not a single year is missing from that record, which is amazing. And from that, you can clearly see the colder winters that existed in the 1800s, late 1800s, compared to now. There's lots of year-to-year fluctuations, but the overall downward trend is unmistakable.
How would you compare ice cover in 1852 on Lake Mendota? When did it freeze over? When did it thaw, as opposed to the last couple of years?
Yeah, so on average, if you take the entire record, it's about 3.5 months long, on average, is how long the duration is. But there were some years in the 1800s, in the 1880s in particular, one year that there was almost 6 months of ice cover. It was over 5 months. So it froze before Thanksgiving, and it thawed in the first week of May. So it's amazing. We haven't had anything like it since. We conceivably could, but there really hasn't been a winter of that magnitude anytime since then.
There was, I don't know if you'd call it a little ice age exactly, but in the 1880s, I mean, there was that phenomenal blizzard in 1888 where you actually had ice flows in the St. Johns River in Florida and drifts, 15, 20 feet high in New York City.
Right. And also that winter of 1881, which is the one I was referring to here, there was a huge blizzard in March of that year, and that dumped a lot of snow on top of the already thick ice on the lake, and that helped to insulate the lake so that the ice persisted longer. And I'm doing some research right now looking at long-term extreme weather trends in the state and Madison in particular, and I find that the 1880s were a remarkably odd decade full of extremes, even more extreme than the current conditions. It remains to be determined why that was.
For heat and cold?
Heat and cold, particularly cold. Winter was the season that was most extreme. But if you look at our long-term precipitation record, by far we had the heaviest rainfalls during that particular decade.
And there was a time in the 1930s, which of course we associate with the Dust Bowl out in the lower Midwest, where even in Wisconsin, a couple of really hot summers.
Right. Yeah, in the 30s, that's when the hottest temperature recorded in Madison, probably the state, occurred. And lots of the highest temperature records around the country were set during those Dust Bowl years in the 1930s.
But we're setting more highs and lows in Wisconsin in the last 10 years than ever before?
Not record highs.
Really?
We've had a reduction in the number of, say, 90-degree days in most parts of the state, which is odd. We've actually had an increase in summertime humidity, which may be a reason why we've kept the air temperature down. I think we've probably had more cloudiness and more humidity, which blocks some sunlight. So it may be that we haven't had such high temperatures, but the apparent temperature or the dew points have been climbing.
So we've had more rather hot days than previously, but not the erratic temperature swings that you see some places.
And not as many of the 90 or 100 mm-hmm. degree days. We did hit 100 in that hot summer in 2012, two or three days, but that was extremely rare. We hadn't done that in 20 years. So those sorts of extremely high temperatures have been decreasing. Whether they'll continue in that trend in the future remains to be seen. But the nighttime temperatures have been climbing in summer, which is indicative of warming, moister climate. And those nighttime temperatures are important from a health factor, too, because during heat waves, a lot of studies have found that it's really the overnight temperatures that determine morbidity and mortality, even more so than the hot daytime temperatures, because the body doesn't have a chance to cool off at night.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. What have we seen in terms of agriculture, things that are no longer possible and things that were not possible before in Wisconsin?
Well, I'm not an expert on agriculture, but I do know that from my studies recently on extreme weather in the state, that the southern third of Wisconsin has had a big increase in variability of rainfall during summer in the last few decades. So we've had, in general, more of these flooding events like we had in 2007 and 2008, to some extent 2010. But we've also had some very dry summers like 2012. And so it's been going back and forth a lot in summer, more than in other seasons, and that makes it very difficult for agriculture for planning purposes.
Well, we're going to look further at the impact of climate change in Wisconsin and other places too, perhaps, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Steve Vavras, and we're looking at climate change, and particularly climate change in Wisconsin. But of course, it's all interconnected, and what happens far from Wisconsin can certainly have an effect on our neck of the woods. One harbinger of climate change, of course, is the change in populations of the animals. And there was recently a mention of the snowshoe hare population in Wisconsin and how the population, yes, you would find it farther north, not as far south as you used to, but those snowshoe hares in the southern part of the range were actually dying. It's not as if they were all moving north, which is almost surprising in a way. But we also hear about bird sightings, birds, you know, farther north than we would expect. Mm-hmm. What is your climatological research found that would account for that?
Yes, I'm working with folks on campus here, Forest and Wildlife Ecology Department, studying that very question. And one of the things that's been noted by them and others is that during periods of extreme heat and sometimes drought, that there's a decline in many types of bird species. But the question about why is not so obvious. So it could be that the heat is overwhelming them and they're dying, young birds and old birds. The other possibility is that the adults are having fewer offspring because they're stressed. Another possibility is that because they're birds, they're flying away somewhere else where it's more favorable. And so ecologists are looking at that question, and I'm coming at it from a climate perspective. But there's clear evidence, for example, during the summer of 2012, that the dick thistle, which is a species that concentrates in the plains, dispersed because of the conditions were so hot and so dry. And so you found fewer dick thistles in the normal central breeding range in the plains and more farther north where it was cooler and wetter. And one of the things that I think is interesting from a climatological point of view is that if that region becomes hotter and drier in the future, which almost all the climate models suggest will happen, what will that do to the bird populations? Will it be a double whammy? Will they have to move somewhere else? Will it mean fewer birds in those locations because they just can't handle the continuous heat stress in the summer? So these are the sorts of places where you find the interface between climatology and ecology.
The place that seems to get the most press, and perhaps because it's a large area and the change seems to be most radical, most noticeable there, is far northern hemisphere, the latitudes approaching the North Pole. Mm-hmm. And we've seen some pretty dramatic changes in the ice pack, for example.
Right. Yeah, the Arctic is warming at 2 to 3 times the rate of the rest of the world, and that's consistent with what we would expect. It's a phenomenon called Arctic amplification, and we see it in the paleoclimate record, and we see it in climate models. It's very well understood. But it also means a very dramatic example of a warming climate. And as you say, we see it in terms of the ice cover, which has declined dramatically in the last 10 years, especially during the summer. So it had been on a long-term decline until about 2007, and then all of a sudden it was like a step jump where it melted by a ridiculously large amount in the summer. And every summer since then, it's fallen to near that same low point. So it's like a step change in the ice cover, which suggests that we're kind of in a new regime of ice pack. And most climate models predict that sometime in this century, we will have seasonal ice cover, which means that the summertime ice pack will be there no more. And we'll certainly have ice in the winter when it refreezes in the cold, but that would be the first time in probably thousands, many thousands of years, most likely, that we would be in a state when the summertime ice pack did not exist anymore.
Well, that would make some, I guess, oil prospectors happy and some transportation entities would, of course, find the fabled Northwest Passage at last for what it's worth. But what would be the cost? What would be the impact?
Right. Well, already there's been a large increase in the amount of transportation and oil and gas exploration in the Arctic. And it's going to come to a head, I think, because there's going to be more and more interest in that. And even the State Department now has become interested in the Arctic because of the potential for geopolitical conflict. That wasn't the case 20 years ago. And so I think countries would be wise to keep a close eye in the Arctic and think about what's going to happen there ecologically and in terms of national security interests.
What will be the effect on, say, the shoreline?
Well, the shoreline, many parts of the Arctic are experiencing some severe coastal erosion, and there are villages that are situated right on many of those coastlines. And along the coast of Alaska, for example, that has been eroding at a remarkably high rate over the last few decades. And that's impacted largely by the loss of summertime ice cover, because the ice pack acts as a dampening effect. So it really suppresses a lot of the wave action. So if you remove that ice pack, you get bigger waves. Bigger waves erode the coast, and that leads to more erosion. At the same time, there's ice in those coastlines, permafrost. As that thaws, you get a slumping coasts, which are more vulnerable to erosion. And then one of the areas that I'm studying is the potential that a warming Arctic with less ice cover could lead to more and stronger storms. So then you have a triple whammy. So you have more waves generated, they're taller, they're not suppressed, and you have coastline slumping.
Well, you mentioned the permafrost, Steve, and isn't it true that there is a vast amount of methane locked up in that frozen ground that's being released as it thaws?
Right, and that is a very popular study topic for many people in my field of Arctic climate change. And I would say the jury is still out on that. You would think what you said is certainly correct, that there's a lot of carbon locked up in that. And if that were to release, especially if it were to become a positive feedback mechanism, more carbon released, more thawing, more carbon released, we'd be in trouble. But even though that seems very plausible, there's a lot of studies that suggest that that wouldn't necessarily happen, because some of that methane would then be taken up by the warmer soils or the extra vegetation in the Arctic. So it's not obvious what will happen, but it's definitely a wild card. And if it were to happen, I think that would be a really amplify the Arctic warming.
So bring that home again in terms of the Arctic. I mean, I already have an inkling of what the effects, say, on Lake Superior would be if mm-hmm. the Arctic is warmer, then you wouldn't have those cold masses, air masses coming down and creating the lake effect snow. But what else is likely to be the consequence from what we've seen so far in the Arctic?
Yeah, so one of the popular study areas I'm involved in is the role that the warming Arctic may have on weather outside of the Arctic, like where we live. And the hypothesis that a colleague of mine, Jennifer Francis at Rutgers, put forth a few years ago was that by warming the Arctic, that we would reduce the temperature contrast between the cold Arctic and the warmer mid-latitudes. And it's that temperature contrast that sets the strength of the jet stream that affects
sure,
our winter
winds,
weather.
Yeah,
right. So a weaker temperature difference between the Arctic and mid-latitudes means a weaker jet stream, all other things being equal. And that alone could have a big impact on the persistence of our weather. But we also see that a weaker jet stream tends to be wavier.
Yes.
And a wavier jet stream tends to produce more extreme weather. And so we put forth this idea that one of the consequences of an Arctic warming would be that we would have a weaker and wavier jet stream in middle latitudes, and that would be favorable for more extreme weather, droughts, heat waves, potentially even cold waves. So this is an area that's being actively researched by ourselves and many, many others around the world.
We usually think of, at least I do, the jet stream as being, up around 49th parallel or, U.S. and Canadian border or maybe even north of that. But then occasionally in these weather forecasts and reports, you'll see that wave you mentioned way down all the way to, like, North Texas or something.
Mm-hmm. Right. So when you get one of these Arctic blasts like we had in January of 2014, the so-called polar vortex, that's when the jet stream dipped way south. And when it does that, it just brings all that cold Arctic air with it. And so one of the complicated questions about this issue of a weaker, wavier jet stream in the future is that effect alone would tend to make it more favorable for some of these cold air intrusions into our area from Canada. But at the same time, those air masses that are coming in from Canada might not be as cold as they are today. So if we had more of them, but they're not as extreme, what would that do? Would that kind of cancel each other out or not? So these are the sorts of questions we're pursuing.
Is it possible, given just maybe 50 years, if that, of awareness of this problem of climate change, and let's presume that it's caused mostly by human activity, have you been able to see any effect on the change in human behavior on affecting, if not reversing, this process of climate change?
You mean human actions to sort of,
yes, have mitigated it at all? Have you seen any evidence of that?
Well, the CO2 levels continue to increase and the methane levels continue to increase. Until the atmospheric rate of increase starts to flatten out, we're still contributing and really promoting the problem. I mean, there are lots of efforts underway, but so far the inertia of an upward trend in these greenhouse gases is winning out.
So it's still accelerating?
It depends on the time period you look at, but it's been going up a lot. I think, in fact, this year, I think the rate of increase of carbon dioxide is the highest since at least 1998. So even though we're wringing our hands and trying to do something about it, in large part because of this warm El Nino we had, but also because carbon emissions around the world keep going up.
Want to take a chance on a kind of a long-range weather forecast for Wisconsin?
How long? I assume you don't mean Monday.
No, we'll put it a little farther out. Of course, the extended forecasts, even a 10-day forecast, is a risky thing because there's so many variables.
Right. Right. Yeah, 10 days is about as far as you can go at the present in terms of being very specific. But one of the advantages we have in climate is that we don't have to be as specific. Nobody's expecting
right.
us to predict the thunderstorm in 2052. But really, the greenhouse warming trend, I think, is going to win out. And the big question is how much warming do we have already in the pipeline, so to speak, that sort of what we can't do much about just from the eventual working through the system.
The sheer momentum of
exactly.
it.
Exactly. And how much of it from this point forward can we do to mitigate it? And we are committed to more warming. I mean, the warming that we've already put in the upper ocean, for example, hasn't even percolated down to the deep ocean. And so there's going to be more warming. But that doesn't mean that we should just give up hope, because the rate of warming and the total overall amount of warming is up to us.
So, in terms of highs and lows in Wisconsin, not much change, but just more of those warm, if not record-setting days?
I think that a good way to look at this is to use the concept of analogs. So you can think of the climate of Wisconsin today, or anywhere today, what was Wisconsin's climate likely to be in the future? So maybe the climate of Champaign-Urbana, Illinois will be the climate of Wisconsin in 50 to 100 years. Maybe it'll be more like St. Louis. Hopefully not. But that's not a bad way to look at it.
And shift everything south, in other words, in terms of your comparison.
Exactly. And it's not a perfect analog. One city might be better analog for temperature. Another might be better for precipitation change. But all of the indications predictions are that the analog, best analog for the future will be somewhere to our south. And in the winter, some people might say, great, milder winters.
Sure.
But I don't know how many people would be happy if we developed the climate of St. Louis in the summer. That's pretty miserable, and it's also not so far away.
Well, perhaps one little bright note, I suppose, is if it gets collectively warmer, then, as you indicated earlier, Steve, we won't be heating it up as much, at least. You won't be putting that kind of, emissions into the atmosphere because it will already have been warmed to a more comfortable temperature.
Yeah, although in the summer, if there's more hot days, then there could be more energy use. And so it's hard to say, but there's certainly potential for increases in energy efficiency. Obviously, renewables have been growing, which is great, more solar, more wind power. And so there are some favorable trends. But as you said, the momentum is so strong. It's, we're trying to change a locomotive that's been moving the same way for 50, 100, maybe 200 years, maybe thousands of years with the advent of agriculture. And so it's not realistic to think we're just going to turn things around on a dime.
I would guess, too, that the other catch in terms of looking at this locally in Wisconsin terms is that what we do in Wisconsin may benefit somebody in Alberta or Japan, whereas what they do, we would be the recipient of because of the way these things drift.
Right. Every has a ripple effect all over the place. But one of the things to consider is that even though it might be tempting to think, well, we're somewhat insulated, say, from sea level rise in Wisconsin, we're far away from a coast, the global economy is so interconnected. And so if there is a huge coastal inundation in Miami or New Orleans, that affects the supply chain for everywhere in the country, if not the world. There have been cases in the last few years where a huge rainstorm or flood in Thailand affected software developers all over the world because the components that were being made in Thailand suddenly couldn't find their way out. And so I think we're going to be seeing more and more examples of this. And so weather changes, climate changes, extreme weather that are happening anywhere in the world have the potential to affect everywhere else in the world.
So what's your next question, and what are you hoping to discover, whether it's Lake Mendota or Lake Superior or the world?
Well, it involved lots of different research projects, many of which we've talked about today. I think this issue, though, of the Arctic, how it will affect the rest of the world, at least the rest of the hemisphere, is a very interesting question. So some things we can predict. It's most likely going to continue to warm a lot in the Arctic. They'll continue to lose ice. That'll raise sea levels. But the effect that it has on weather patterns is a very complicated one and one that needs to be addressed, and many people are working on it right now.
And not a factor in the Antarctic just because it's a bigger landmass and it's going to be much slower to react?
Exactly, right. So the Antarctic and the Arctic are complete mirror images geographically. So the Antarctic is a big landmass ice sheet surrounded by water, and the Arctic is the water surrounded by land. And so the Arctic would be expected to respond more quickly, and it has. The Antarctic is a bigger problem in terms of sea level rise because you've got an enormous amount of ice that could be melted, the West Antarctic ice sheet being the more vulnerable one. Smaller but more reactive. And so if the sea levels rise by a meter, which is kind of a common prediction in the next 100 years, that would spell big trouble for many coastal cities around the world, including in the U.S., Miami, New Orleans, and during storm surges, New York and others. So the question of how sensitive these ice sheets are to sea level rise is a very, very popular hot topic right now.
Well, in case there was ever any doubt, we are all inextricably connected, aren't we?
Absolutely.
Because of the effect that the climate will have on all of us, regardless of whether we're here or on the other side of the world.
Right. The atmosphere knows no boundaries.
Well, Steve Avras, thanks for sharing some of your research and insights into this phenomenon of climate change in Wisconsin and other parts of the world, too.
Thank you, Norman. I enjoyed it.
I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.